Hi again, folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again. Thanks for joining us today. We've got another interview lined up for you today. With us on the line from Tokyo is Shai Greenberg, Vice President of Genkai Capital Management, which is an independent real estate investment management company. Their focus is mainly real estate fund management, asset management, and advisory services here in Japan, as well as in other parts of South Asia and North America. Shai, like myself, was born and raised in Israel, and after graduating from university there, moved on to Japan, New York for grad school and a stint at a Wall Street investment bank, and back to Japan again, where he took on a senior management role at Cushman & Wakefield, where, similar to his previous positions, he dealt mainly with large real estate investment deals, representing large blue-chip companies, institutional clients. Whereas today, at his role at Genkai, he's also representing domestic institutional funds and so forth, dealing mainly again in larger commercial real estate projects, such as office buildings, logistics facilities, and so forth. A lot of the things that we've been talking about here in past episodes. He's also an adjunct professor at both Tokyo Temple University and New York University, where he also studied real estate finance and investment, teaching courses such as real estate investment fundamentals, including valuations, due diligence, finance, and similar subjects. So it's probably safe to say that he spent a substantial part of his adult life knee-deep in commercial real estate transactions, and a very large part of it here in Japan. He's also more than fluent in all things related to raising capital, structuring of funds, debt, equity, and so forth. So we thought it would be a great asset to have him on the podcast. Shai, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So before we start talking shop, could you maybe tell us a bit about your own personal journey? What led you to Japan in the first place? And maybe more specifically, when did the interest in real estate start?
So Japan, you know, always had some sort of unexplainable attraction to Japan. So in my undergrad, I studied Tokyo University of Asset Management and East Asian Studies with a minor in Japan, so Japan culture, literature, and also a little bit of Japanese. Nobody could actually speak after they graduated, but the foundation was there. So I was looking for a way to get to Japan, and, you know, from Israel, you either have IT or diamonds, which are, I think, the two largest probably outside of security, but probably the two largest export industries. So for some reason, I don't know why, I thought diamonds sounded more interesting. So I went into the diamond trade, or the diamond dealer. That got me to Japan in the first place.
Okay. And you moved here in 2006 and then again in 2012, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So I came to Japan. At first I worked in as a diamond dealer for the beer site holder, and we're selling the wholesale to manufacturers and chain stores here in Japan. But after a while it got a little bit boring. I was looking for more challenges. So I decided to go back to school. Went to grad school, attended NYU, studied real estate finance and investment, and then came back to Japan in 2012, like you rightly said.
Okay. So, and how did you find the transition into the Japanese working environment? I mean, there must have been a lot that struck you as completely different from the Western business environment, let alone the Israeli one that you were used to at the time.
Oh my God, I mean, I'm still adjusting. I think it's a lifelong adjustment. Somebody that studied with me in New York put it in a way, says, you know, Japan is a moon colony. It's different than anything else, you know, you've experienced ever. The way you negotiate, the subtleties, you know, where to push and where to, you know, put your foot off the pedal and all of that. It needs a lot of adjustment. So, you know, we Israelis tend to do well in environments where they used to be very aggressive, like New York. But in Japan, it's probably the other way around. If you lose your temper, you basically lost.
That's it. You're gone.
Yeah.
And throughout your time here, have you always been involved in mainly these larger commercial real estate deals with local foreign investors? How do you find the profile of clients that you deal with different in their investment attitudes?
So I dealt with mainly inbound corporation who in a previous role who are coming to Japan and were either leasing or buying or had a portfolio of properties that they inherited through M&A and wanted to know what to do with it, how to handle the portfolio, what's the best way to utilize it. So that was one side of investment. Now I'm working in a Japanese company, and most of the great majority of our investors are institutional Japanese investors. So they have a lot of different needs and wants and different cost of capital, etc. So either we're doing things domestically with them or outbound as well, looking at outbound investments as well.
Right. And how about finance, raising capital, or do they always come with their own capital or structuring their equity-based deals? I mean, we offer, for example, hear complaints from foreign investors about the reluctance of Japanese banks to lend to anyone who doesn't have a really well-established corporate or at least a residential base in the country. When you deal with foreign investors, do you find this to be true? Have things changed at all?
Generally, I believe it to be true for the smaller property types. What's happened when you deal with the larger property types, you get into specific investment structures that kind of like mitigate that risk. A lot of the larger properties are actually, if you pull out the title for the property, you see it's owned by one of the trust banks. So basically, the property is sold to a trust where the trust is issuing, trust beneficiary interests that are held by the investor. Actually, the owner will not be the investor, it will be the trust bank. Similarly, there is all those fund or syndication structures like GKTK or TMK, where you actually have an asset manager such as ourselves, licensed asset manager with a good track record. And the loans of this size are non-recourse loans in any case. So they're not really looking for personal guarantees. So if there is experienced local manager with a track record, even though, most of the economic interest is held by a foreign entity, that is still works for the local lenders and their happy to lend money for those type of deals.
Okay, so that's very different from what we're used to dealing with the smaller or the individual investors. So where do you think that line is drawn? Is it a matter of deal size that makes it easier or the profile of the ownership? When does it actually change from a reluctance to lend into a more of an acceptance for foreign investors?
So doing all this structuring is obviously not without cost. And so it only makes sense for larger deals. So I think I would say you'd probably see the non-recourse loans start from probably around, I would say, 10 million US
right.
and upwards.
Yeah.
Where anything below that is probably a recourse deal. But a recourse deal, put yourself in the lender's shoes, right? I mean, if you have the power that is not a resident of that country, regardless if it's a fantastic power, but in their narrow point of view, it's a flight risk. So if they lend money and things go south and they need his recourse, they need to put their hands on his properties, etc., it's very difficult or close to impossible for them if everything he owns is in Australia or, in the U.S. or somewhere in Asia. That's what I think. This is the reason why they try to avoid those borrowers.
So, having the property that's being purchased itself as security would not be sufficient for them.
Most smaller loans, they look at it as full recourse loans. I'm sure we're going to mention, recent. Events in the capital markets in Japan later on, but in a great extent, a lot of the smaller banks look at it as a personal loan with the benefit of security of a property.
Right, so they want to go after the investor in person if they have to.
Yeah, I mean, because otherwise the loan that some of them made makes absolutely no sense in the context of real estate only loan, right?
Right.
So it took me a while to understand why some of the banks were, you know, lending the way they're lending, but then I figured out, well, if you look at it in the sense of it's a consumer loan with the benefit of having security of a property, it made a lot of sense.
Oh, it does actually, yes. Okay, that makes it a lot clearer for me too. And did you see any changes maybe this year? We had the Surrogas scandal.
What I was alluding to. I mean, for those of you who don't know, there was a bank that was probably one of the most aggressive lenders, and they lended to a lot of groups that were kind of like unloved by the capital markets in Japan. So a lot of foreigners, people with maybe lower credits, and they were very aggressive. They were lending at very high loan-to-value ratios, at properties that were, let's call it, not the best properties, some of them. And as it turned out to be, they were had a lot of defaults on their loan book because of one specific deal with a share housing company called Kabuchan Obasha, that they had a very large concentration of loans with them, and it turns out to be that they were overly aggressive on the underwriting, etc. So the regulator stepped in and started looking at all of their books, find out a couple of things, senior management stepped down, and there were ripple effects across the entire capital markets, full recourse loan type lenders, banks that kind of like took a step back and said, okay, you know, very conservative, let's wait and see what's going on. Maybe we don't want to be the next one on the regular calling list.
Mm. And you felt that? Yeah, I mean, you physically felt effects in your work as well.
So, us not so much, because it didn't, so the 10 million up, the non-recourse lending world, did not really see the effect of that, but I know that smaller loans, so smaller properties had a lot of effect. There's a lot in the professional Japanese real estate media about how much of a hit some of the larger publicly traded brokerage shops took because of that, etc. So there was definitely a big effect on the real estate market. And some of the companies that we do work with that has, let's say, large apartment development arms, apartment as in not condominiums for sale, but condominiums for investment, they took a hit too, because a lot of those salaryman investors could not get loans.
All right, so the effect on the personal loan market also affected the property arena.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, well, I mean, yeah, you're probably in a bit of a unique position. You've worked with both domestic and foreign investors, and you're dealing with property investments both in and out of Japan. Could you maybe point out some current trends for us as far as the interest in Japanese real estate goes, domestically, internationally? I mean, from our, again, limited perspective on our end of the market, it seems as if there's more interest in the market here since Abe-san took over in 2012, but over the last 2-3 years, there seem to be a lot less attractive deals to be found. Investors are maybe holding on to their assets, maybe because there just aren't that many good alternatives around. Have you noticed similar or maybe a different impression?
Absolutely. I mean, it's extremely difficult to find good deals. In general, especially the better quality, high, you know, very expensive type of real estate rarely changes hands. It's always kept by the developer group that owns it. Think about Marunouchi area in Tokyo. I mean, none of those buildings hardly ever traded, right? Those type of Class A office buildings hardly never trade. So it's very difficult for very deep-pocketed, let's say, sovereign wealth fund or something like that. It needs a big investment to move the needle for them to come to Japan and buy those type of billion-plus properties. That's rarely ever happens. So it's tough, for sure.
And smaller deals? More available, less available?
I think on individual investor type deals, I think there's a lot more liquidity on let's say 10 million plus. There's more liquidity. I mean, it's a pyramid, right? The lower you get, the more liquidity you have. Mm. Things are trading. I think maybe now with the smaller properties, because of what's happening in the capital markets, there might be some properties that will reluctantly be put on the market, but maybe I don't think there will be a wave. I think it will be maybe a property here, a property there, because those loans are typically written for a very long duration, so maybe 30-year loan. So there really is no, you know, refinance event that you need to refinance in 5 years. And oh my God, I can't get a loan. Yeah. And I got to sell the property. That's not going to happen. But if there's a default, it might happen.
Okay. And in that space, in the entire commercial space, what types of properties are getting the most attention, in your opinion?
So, last couple of years, for sure, you know, the bell of the ball was logistics. Similar to what happening in other places in Japan too, Amazon, we have our own version of Amazon, Rakuten, are increasing in sales and decreasing the delivery time. So logistic properties are popping up everywhere, up until a point that everybody got into this game. And some markets are said to be overbuilt, but it's still going very, very, very strong. Mm. So that's for sure. In recent years, you know, there has been a tremendous growth in inbound tourism to Japan. Like, unbelievable to a stable economy, you know, like Japan, to see in any industry a growth of 40%, 30%, 20-some percent year over year, it's tremendous. So a lot of people are also getting into the business of building hotels. A lot of the international brands really, really want a foothold in Japan if they don't have one already. And so everybody are joining into this asset class as well.
Gotcha. So hospitality, definitely a thing. Do you think that's going to peter off towards the Olympics or the World or right after the Olympics or the World Expo, or will that be a lasting trend?
I mean, my personal opinion, I think it's a lasting trend because I think Japan is just a fantastic tourist destination. Mm. I think everybody that comes to Japan, do you agree? Yeah. And I think that everybody comes to Japan, they come again. Because when they come to Japan the first time, it's a week and they see all the Kyoto and Tokyo and that's it. And the next time they go to the second cycle and third time they go to the third cycle of cities. And there's a lot of great places to see in Japan. But not only that, when they come to Japan, they're surprised because everybody has the image in mind that Japan is the most expensive place
exactly.
in the world.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking.
But it's not anymore.
Mm.
It's not anymore. After 12, you know, 15 years of depression.
Deflation.
When you come here and you compare the meal cost of the restaurant here versus the meal cost of the restaurant in almost any other city in the world, it's actually pretty affordable.
Right.
And hotels as well, and transportation, except for maybe bullet trains, also not that expensive. So it's a great destination. They go home and they tell, you know, the five friends that they meet every Friday about what they found out, and then those five friends come, and those five friends tell the other five friends, and this is a virtuous cycle. I think I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
Okay, so hospitality definitely a thing, hopefully beyond the next few years. Logistics facilities you've mentioned, so e-commerce moving towards next or same day delivery. Anything about assisted senior living? We've been hearing quite a lot about that just due to the aging population.
Yeah. One caveat about the Australia before I go, that you know, a very large chunk of the tourists coming to Japan are from China. So if anything happens with the China-Japan relationship or a Chinese stop traveling or something like that, that Japanese tourism may take it in. They're trying very hard to diversify the inbound tourism portfolio, and I hope they'll be able to make it. But that's one caveat. Regarding senior housing, we're also investing in senior housing, but the promise is there. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you look at the demographics, and there's now a couple of REITs. But if you look at the REITs, which is in the public market, so the information is there, you see it hasn't taken off. It's a difficult asset class because there is really a very limited amount of credit-worthy operators with limited capacity, and a lot of very, very granular mom-and-pop owned small properties that are not investment grade. If you're looking at, you know, those type of REITs type. And there was also an issue about a year back with some terrible incident in a senior health facility where one of the caregivers was throwing elderly people off the balcony.
I remember that one.
And that's the entire business took a turn because people invested in thinking, wow, it's like multifamily, it's like office, but actually there are other risks because, you know, people's lives are at stake. So that's another consideration. So it seems like a very logical play, but for some reason it hasn't taken off yet.
Okay, maybe it's just for lack of, like you say, larger operators who can, because you've also mentioned at the start that the financing would be tied into the asset management, right?
Yes.
So if we don't have any large operators that are credible and can be counted on, that's going to be a problem. And maybe there's just not enough just business models out there to support that. Anything about shared office spaces? We've seen that to be here in Fukuoka and in Tokyo as well. That seems to be taking off a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that concept has been around for a while. I mean, I think Japan is one of the richest, and you know, the other operators, large markets. But it's been on steroids since WeWork came to town. WeWork came to town and they're just taking up a lot of office space, fitting out really, really nice. And they're running on very, very high occupancy rates from the get-go. So the business model seems to be taking off in Japan as well.
Interesting. Any particular challenges that you see for domestic international investors? Again, leading into the Olympics, we've mentioned hospitality, but then we had a whole big thing with, you've mentioned people are building hotels, but Airbnb took a serious hit here.
Yes.
So any particular challenges on any of those fronts?
I'm not sure if the Olympics itself, you know, the momentum is great, but I'm not sure if the Olympics itself would have such a huge effect on commercial real estate, aside maybe from hospitality, but I think hospitality would have some really, really good year after the Olympics. You know, if you look at other cities that had hosted the Olympic Games, the best years of hospitality were not the Olympic year, but the following years, because I'm sure they're going to have really nice problems with Japan, and few people are eager to come and watch people run, but they all watch it on TV, you know, one time or the other. So say, wow, this Japan looks really beautiful, I want to go. And they come the next year or the following year when they save money for it. I think there is a lot of capacity on the side of construction workers that will free up once the Olympics is gone, because a lot of the construction work I tied up with either reconstruction after the natural disasters or Abenomics related infrastructure products or the Olympics. But once the Olympic is done, you have a lot of capacity. So that will probably affect secondary market condos. A lot of developers are sitting on land parcels that are unable to develop because construction costs are too expensive. So once that, and they're too expensive, not because of commodity prices, but because of shortage of labor.
Mm-hmm.
So when that labor is released to the market, I think those projects are going to start getting built, and that might affect apartment prices in secondary markets because you're going to have more supply.
Okay, so residential is might see an uptick. Anything else in the residential sector that we should be looking out for? Share houses, again, we've mentioned share offices. Share houses are also expanding. Anything exciting in the residential sector that you're aware of?
You mentioned that Airbnb took a hit in Japan. It took a hit where a lot of individual owners were listing properties that it's now a little bit difficult to do, but what you see a wave of smaller developers taking over buildings or developing properties and licensing them as a dormitory, which allows you in turn to list it as Airbnb. So you really, really see a wave of those coming. Another version of a multifamily, so they take over the entire multifamily, so they don't have to worry about what the other tenants think, and they get the license, and then they can register it according to the Japanese law. So there's absolutely no issue with that. You see a lot of, I think there's a lot of opportunities in that space.
So when you say dormitory license, is that a sub-branch of the hotel or the Yokan licensing?
Yes. It's slightly less requirements in terms of fire safety, putting on reception on the ground floor, etc. So it's a little bit of an easier route.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thanks for your time, Chai. That was very educational for myself as well, and hopefully profitable for many of our listeners. Thank you very much. Folks, if you've got any questions at all for Chai, please feel free to post them in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode, or directly on our podcast page on Podigy itself. You can find all of those easily. Just Google Japan Real Estate Podcast or search the iTunes store for Japan Real Estate Podcast. We're always first on that list. Do share this content with anyone who may find it interesting on your own networks. And most importantly, if you can spare a moment of your time, please leave us a rating. Leave us a rating, good or bad, on the iTunes store, on Spotify, wherever you might have found us. We look forward to having you with us next time. And until then, from all of us here at NTI and Genkai Capital, we wish you, as always, happy investing.